I'm John Herzog, and today we'd like to talk about muddling towards frugality or the politics of energy. As quite a few of you have been at other sessions, you've seen how the United States' energy consumption has been doubling. It was doubling about every 25 years up until about 1975 on an exponential growth. That oil production in the United States peaked in the year 1970 and has been, for the most part, on a decrease ever since, and most likely will continue that way. That we are using up the world's fossil fuels and they are starting to become scarce. And that this simply cannot continue. You cannot continue exponential growth when you have a limited resource. So something will have to happen. And in fact, the age of the fossil fuels is probably going to be so short that many of the lesser developed countries are never even going to get in on it. The fossil fuel age is going to have bypassed them and they won't even know it has come and gone.
Maybe that's to their advantage. They don't have to go backwards again, maybe.
Well, how did the United States become so consumptuous of things and the throwaway society and all that? Well, for one thing, we started with basically a virgin continent. That the settlers that came here found a vast continent with few people on it. Those that were here, the Indians, were self-sustaining and not using more than what they needed to live on. Some people claim that the religious heritage was such that they should essentially rape the earth. That they look at Genesis 1:28, where it says, "Subdue the earth and have dominion over all living things." I don't quite think they're reading the whole passage, because if you read farther in that verse, it says that we are to replenish the earth. So I don't personally think that that's a Christian advocate. It may be that way, but it certainly isn't what it says to me. Also, the early people had racial discrimination, and that was an economic boon to them at that time. For free labor, it has certainly been a high price for society to pay later on. There were economic and political doctrines that encouraged individual freedom at the expense of family and social responsibility. The Industrial Revolution, of course, started in the 1700s, which was about the time our country was being developed, and that it basically allowed us to start in free on the Industrial Revolution. The European countries had already made a lot of the mistakes and trial and errors on what would work, and here when this country was started then, they could do the things that worked in this vast country. Also on the economic and political doctrines, it seemed right that people should become rich in this country, and I guess for the most part it was okay to do so at the expense of others. And the government has gradually been taking over the social responsibility that, at least for an agricultural society, would fall on the family. So that our doctrine has broken up, in a sense, the families and communities. Also, we had millions of immigrants that came over here bringing skills. And then in the 19th century, we saw the marriage of science and technology. Up until then, there had been great thinkers and theories, but most things had not been put into practice. And during the 19th century and continuing through the 20th century, theories from the past have been put into practice, and it's getting now so that if somebody thinks up a theory, that seems to be going into practice almost immediately. There's a very short lag time between when somebody thinks up a theory and when it's being actually used. And of course, we had great mineral wealth in this country and fossil fuels, extremely abundant for the size of the country and for the number of people that were here. And they certainly were used. Also, we got many cheap raw materials from other nations that they didn't realize the value of them at that time, and under their society had no use for them, so we got many cheap materials. Now, of course, these things are getting expensive, and while our society, for the most part, is built on the throwaway idea, which assumes that you have cheap materials, that means that we run into problems. Well, there are a lot of other reasons, such as ambitious people and the oceans on two sides, so that we didn't get involved in wars on our land, at least. You know, we had good schools and automobiles and efficient transportation and advertising and all sorts of things. But at any rate, where has this led us to, and what kind of problems has it caused? Well, for one thing, high technology becomes vulnerable to various things. For example, you need high compliance of orders to keep things going. A small group for instance, that strike or slow down can have a great effect when you have a high technology, because if they, somebody in a generating plant or transportation system or anything, they can tie up a lot of people, just a few of them can do that. And of course, high technology becomes targets for sabotage, where one person putting off a bomb at some one place can really inconvenience a lot of people. And then also, you need adequate supplies of technically trained people to keep everything going. Well, another thing in this country is maybe we've had too much emphasis on our rights and not enough emphasis on our responsibilities. Maybe this is where the people that claim the Christians are to blame for some of this haven't been reading the rest of the Genesis either, that while we have rights to do certain things, we have responsibilities to replenish the earth, and maybe we have more responsibilities than many of us are assuming. Well, any industrial society has a tendency to break up families and communities. When you're in an agricultural family, you all work together and you have children to help you in your work and maybe to be a security for your old age to take care of you. When you get into, children are a benefit to have children, while in our society, when you have both parents working and generally industrialization where you do not work in the home, it has a tendency to break up the family and also to break up the community so that you aren't as dependent on the people around you. And the automobile certainly has helped in that. Well, now it seems that the energy has been one of the main things that has gotten this going. The cheap energy that we have used up, that maybe we've used up what should belong to our children and grandchildren. And the question comes, where do we go from here? Well, we've looked at some of the energy options in other sessions, but I suppose another way of it is to say that we have two options. We can go from our petroleum addiction into plutonium addiction and just keep building nuclear plants galore and have high technology. Or we can live annually with what comes from the sun. And that would imply going solar. Now, of course, just because you go solar doesn't mean that you aren't going to go big technology, because there are proposals to build huge solar energy plants too. But generally, if you go solar, you expect to have things more dispersed, more smaller plants, more individual people having their own solar heat and things of that type. Now, we might think things look bad for us, but in Japan and Europe, really, they are much worse off. For one thing, we use about twice as much energy per person as they do, which means that we should be able to conserve or cut our consumption in half and still at least should seemingly live as well as they do. They can't really do that. If they cut theirs in half, they're down quite a bit. Also, they have less sun than we do, so that solar is not as promising in Europe or in Japan as it would be here. And they have very little coal or oil or natural gas. And we have not the world's biggest supply of coal, but we are the second biggest resource as far as coal is left, and there is a lot of coal. And we still have a fair amount, have some oil too. Well, I suppose we could say that encouraging the use of oil is only going to speed up the time when we're going to have to make some dramatic changes. And if we're going to make changes, the best thing is for them to come gradually. The worst thing is to all of a sudden come up to the top and say, that's it, now we have to really make a change. And any society change, it's to the benefit of society if it can be done slowly, not with one big abrupt change. Of course, another problem that's been facing us and still is the population increase. The world's population is increasing at a rate of over 2% per year, which means that the world's population doubles then every 35 years. And there are currently about close to 5 billion people in the world. Only 6% of those live in the United States, and we use one-third of the world's energy. So we're certainly using more than our so-called fair share. But in 35 years, which is not that far away, then the population of the world at this continued rate would be up to close to 10 billion people. And you go another 35 years, that would double up to 20 billion. And another 35, which would only be 105 years from now, a really short time, you would be up to, what were we at, 20? We would be up to 40 billion people. So that's what, 8 times as many people as there are in the world today, you know, 100 years from now. It's questionable if we can support that many people in the world. Well, of course, why are there more people in the world? High birth rates. Another reason, of course, is lower death rates. Medicine has made for longer lives. And sometime along the way, that the Earth is going to reach a point where it can't sustain more growth. And we'll have to have reached replacement births before that time occurs, because if you get to the point where each family has 2 children just to replace themselves, the world's population will continue to grow for at least 2 centuries beyond that, just because of all of the people that are already in the pipeline, that will, the young ones becoming older now, and the population will still grow for at least 2 generations. So we better have gotten to the replacement time where we just replace each other before we reach that saturation point. Well, in the book Awakening from the American Dream, Rufus Miles claims that the limits to on human capacity to design and manage complex systems is about reaching its zenith, and that this is probably going to limit continued growth more than the resources. Now, you might contend with that, but that's what he claims. And he also claims, and I guess this is true, that the more energy you use, the more interdependence you have between people. For instance, right now, the countries, well, most countries are depending upon the Mideast to get their oil. And there is great dependence on one country. What happens in one country has a great effect on what happens in another. Also, Miles claims that the church should face up to the ethics that deals with the preservation of the human race and the improvement of the human condition, and get more things into the doctrines on the ethics of ecology. Now, in other words, emphasize more the replenishing of the earth. It is true that philosophers and religious thinkers, way back to Socrates, have proclaimed, in a way, a paradox that man is able to live a more abundant life if he lives with less. And I think that's still true, and that we probably will have to go back to that. So that, again, there are really 2 things, then. We must somehow reduce our material consumption, and that's especially the industrialized countries, and we must reduce birth rates if we are going to continue to have decent lives. And of course, the paradoxical thing there is that the birth rates are considerably higher in the countries that can least support them. The lesser developed countries have birth rates that are quite above 2% per year, while you get into the industrialized countries and your birth rates are more around 1% a year. So that doesn't seem right either. Well, certainly the United States affluence was a freak happening that it's probably not likely to happen again, where a country has all this space, all these resources, and everything works out to have the energy to use to get things going. Well, certainly we'll have to undergo a value change, I think, that we will lead our lives with less material goods, that we're going to have to do more, get more of our satisfaction out of reading books, crafts, whatnot, quite a few of the things you do around Holt Village, really, that we simply cannot use something and throw it away, and that is going to be the life to come. But we do not want an abrupt change. It must be done in a gradual way. We can't just automatically stop all automobiles like that. You'll disrupt a society, and that will lead to terrorism and whatnot else. So it has to be done in a slower way. Well, how do we go about doing this? You know, the textbook way of doing making a decision is for the manager to establish objectives and some values on which his decisions will be based, and then to identify and analyze means to achieve those objectives. And then thirdly, you select the policy that will best achieve your desired objective. But this isn't the way it usually works in practice, because for one thing, a manager usually doesn't have the time to read all the information or to get all the knowledge that's needed, or maybe doesn't have the intellectual capacity to make a really rational, comprehensive decision. And I think that's true in most cases. You don't really have time to look at it. You have all sorts of other things going on that you have to do too. And not only that, but then there's usually no one single objective that seems to come out as the one that you need to push. Because, say, you're a politician. Do you look at what you really think is best, or do you do what you think your constituency wants you to do, or do you do what your colleagues think you ought to do so that you'll get their votes on another vote? And it isn't a clear-cut thing. So what usually you do is you end up making a small step towards what you want to have done, and it makes a little contribution to the issue at hand, but not much. And this is really what we mean by just muddling along. You address it a little bit, but you don't really make a big decision, so that you have, in a sense, a series of compromises that fully satisfy nobody. Well, it's argued that this maybe is the better way for things to go on, that you avoid the great big mistakes where you think you have the true way of doing it, and you make the decision. And say you have a strongman government and they make this decision and it turns out to be wrong, and then you really are in problems. So some people argue that's better, and it also, it gets away from the one-man rule, I guess. Well, then what do we mean by frugal? If we're muddling towards frugality, from Latin, frugal means to have a meaningful use or to be worthy or fruitful. And this is the sense we'd like to use it today, although I think most people think of frugal as being thrifty or not lavish today. So how can we muddle towards fruitfulness? Well, obviously can't continue on our exponential growth rates that we have had. Certainly, I suppose it'll imply that we'll have to go to more human labor, that there will have to be more things done by human labor. I think we'll have to go back to more community life, where you know your neighbors and have more to do with them, and that we'll have to become more environmentally aware of what's around us and think of the environment more. Now, Warren Johnson, in his book, Muddling Towards Frugality, which, by the way, is available, it's on reserve in the library here, and also Awakening from the American Dream by Rufus Miles is also on reserve here in the library and is also in the bookstore that you might, on the paperback, you might wish to purchase. But anyway, Warren Johnson, he predicts that there will be no big collapse, that we won't overreach, but that there is just going to be a gradual muddling along of decisions, and we'll gradually become more frugal. By the way, if you have questions along the way, we'll certainly have discussion afterwards, but if you have things along the way, I guess ask or make comments too. I hope this brings up a few controversial things that you'll want to say. In nature, equilibrium is reached. If you have, if the predator for a certain animal for some reason disappears or is killed, then a certain species will keep growing in population. And everything seems fine. There's no predators on them, but then pretty soon they oversaturate and they overgraze or overfeed on whatever there is. And they become weak, and some disease either strikes them or some new predator comes along and doesn't wipe them out completely, but reduces them so that the stronger survive, and a new equilibrium is achieved. Well, Rufus Miles would say that will happen to us too, and that if we overpopulate, eventually something will happen and we will be gone back to an equilibrium state. Of course, the thing we want to avoid is where this going back is some catastrophe of a worldwide calamity We certainly don't want it to be nuclear war or something of that type, where not only does it put you back to an equilibrium, but probably destroys everybody. Well, if we are going to be muddling towards frugality, what are some of the dangers that could occur? Certainly it's not all clear-cut. Well, for one thing, is that as this economic pie starts to shrink, there's going to be a tendency that everybody is going to say, well, I'm going to keep my share that I have. And obviously that can't be the case. We can't all keep our same share if the total pie is shrinking. And there's going to be groups then that are going to try to say, well, maybe a certain union or class of workers that, okay, the rest of you can take the cut, but we're going to keep ours. Well, if you're in a democratic society, it's probably not going to happen that way, because no group can be large enough to get enough support to do that. If they are large enough to get support for their whole group to maintain their pie, their group is too large to benefit from it anyway, because if they're trying to get a larger piece of a pie and the total pie is shrinking, that simply can't happen. So maybe we don't have to worry about it after all. Well, Warren Johnson says that if we maintain our sense of humor, accept the world as it is, and endeavor to make the most of it, then we should have no fear of the future. I guess the one thing that we might compare it to is the tragic hero and the comic hero. You know, the tragic hero is the one who has a cause, believes completely in it, and will do anything for it, will die for it, and is willing to have others die in the process of when he's dying too. And you know, maybe that's not so good. Maybe that would lead to where somebody would put off the world into atomic war, nuclear war or something, and take everybody with him. While the comic hero, you know, more or less takes things as it is, as they are, and tries to win little victories, tries to outwit the one in charge for just a little victory, and takes life as it is, and tries to enjoy what's there. And maybe that's what's needed for humanity to survive. Well, before I go on any further, I don't think it should affect that. No, I don't envision it being quite that way. Certainly, there's no way we can all, you know, people say, go back to the land, and that's impossible. There's just simply too many people for everybody to go out and have their little piece of land and be self-sufficient. That is not going to happen. But I do think there is going to be more movement back to the smaller communities where you depend more on your neighbor. I mean, I think I go back home to my folks or my mother's place back in Minnesota and see how things go, and it's just a small town of 400. And a lot of the people drive more than they have to, I guess. But you know, you can live in a small community like that and get along with a lot less than we seemingly use in some of the bigger cities, at least, and it seems like most people do where I live anyway. And I suppose you might have your small garden for certain things, but no, I don't envision it going back to that.
You mentioned that the Europeans only use about half the energy.
Per person?
Yeah, when I travel, I go to Europe quite frequently, and last year they expected to travel too, and I really don't feel that they miss out anything. I'm wondering where actually the cut is, because everybody seems, they run cars, but they're generally small. Mm-hmm. Quite often only one car in the family. The only thing I did not come across in any of my friends' home was a dishwasher. They did not have a dishwasher, but they had washing machines. They did not dry their clothes. They had clothes dryers, but they only used it if it was rainy weather. If it was nice weather, their clothes went outside to dry. They kept their homes adequately heated.
But a lot cooler than most people here do here.
No, they were actually, I was there in the summer, but I did ask them what they kept the temperature at, and they said, nobody told me they kept it under 65, and many people around 67. That's what I was told.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering, now there wasn't the only thing I noticed, a lot that I have noticed here, and I think it's because the lack of public transport, there wasn't quite the chauffeuring around of the kids there so well. You know, I mean, some of my neighbors, now we live on bus lines, and I don't drive, so my daughter, unless my husband takes her, she catches the bus, and we live in suburbia, we live in Bellevue, and there's two bus lines and she can catch it. But those children where we live, it's a fairly affluent area actually, but these children never catch a bus. Their mothers will take them everywhere. And so that's sort of a waste of gas.
Yeah, there are many ways.
Yeah, the mothers live in the car, you know.
Yes. There certainly are many ways we can conserve in that sense. Driving, getting automobiles that don't use as much gasoline. Our homes, I bet you found that they, for the most part, had smaller homes than we do. They don't try to heat as many square feet as we do. And probably their bedrooms are not as heated.
One thing was, you know, the home I live in here, one side of our living room, is just about all glass. Well, that is unheard of in Europe. You know, their windows are pretty small, and then they have double windows, and there are no such a thing as picture windows. They're just not there. But I think the new American homes are also built much more. Ours is a 20-year-old home, you know, no thought for energy efficiency. But I think the new homes are built much more efficiently.
Well, yes, and that's certainly anything that's new, if it isn't built with solar energy in mind these days, I think it's a mistake that that at least to get passive solar energy, which is free energy, and that's certainly something we'll have to do, and to put your windows on the south so you do get that energy and ways to conserve it. I'm sure that we can cut our energy consumption back. We have. Our energy consumption in this country peaked in 1979. Now, you know, if you go back 10 years ago, everybody, I shouldn't say everybody, but I think probably everybody would agree with it. They had projections of energy growth, and they were exponential. You know, we've been growing exponentially, and they kept projecting exponential growth. And it slowed down some in 73, and it did start to grow again, and now energy consumption in this country peaked in 1979. It has gone down in 1980, and it went down again in 1981, and indications are that our energy consumption will be down again this year. Now, that's good, but on the other hand, there are some prices we've paid, and there's unemployment, too. And, you know, when you look back in history, the energy consumption in this country went down during the Depression of the 30s also. So, you know, what does it take to get us out of that?
Well, Japan set a model that the last 3 years they've been reducing energy consumption and increasing their gross national product. First time in the history of industrialization.
Yes, if you look at gross national products and energy consumption over the past, it's almost a perfect correlation there that the countries with the best higher gross national product also had the higher energy consumption. But yeah, they have shown that it can be done now. Yes?
You've been emphasizing the notion that we must go slowly. I was curious if you also have the fear with that notion that that would lead to that notion that people will try to prognosticate and then manipulate the future, which, of course, would probably be a losing proposition. We don't know what's going to happen in the future, such as we've probably found in our automobiles and such, that these all may be good things, but maybe the timing is off. We've tried to manipulate too much. Could we have that fear that there will be certain groups in the country who will try to manipulate our future in energy rather than allowing a certain amount of time to go by to see which direction should we go? I have that fear.
Well, yeah, that's why
sudden manipulation is going to be very dangerous.
That's why Johnson claims that muddling is best, where you don't allow this big decision, where you just make small steps along the way. Some might be wrong, some might be right, but you haven't made such a huge step which
there'll be a certain intelligence in that muddling.
Okay, yeah, you might read The Politics of Energy by Barry Commoner, and he looks at the energy situation and again claims there's, as just about everybody realizes, that there's two basic ways to go to get our future energy. Either we go nuclear, if you're good for getting a lot of energy, or you go solar. And he's afraid that by lack of any decision at all, that by default, just because of the way the government seems to keep spending money on nuclear energy, that that's the way we're going to go, and he sees that as he doesn't even look at the waste energy or the waste problem. He looks at it economically, and Barry Commoner would claim that going nuclear would be the greatest economic lunacy that has ever happened in the world.
Whoops.
Whoops, yeah. Those of you from Washington know what that means, the Washington Public Power Supply System. And we've seen how that at least could be right. And that's probably the way I feel, is that nuclear is probably going to die its death more from the economic standpoint than it is from anything to do with the nuclear waste.
Have you seen Red Rifkin's entropy and his condition, second law of thermodynamics?
Well, yeah, we always have that.
A paradigm of existence, and the fact that everything moves from order to disorder, and basically we're in the process of we're in a very fast process of deterioration now, and the only hope there is just to slow that process down.
Yeah,
his contention is there's a real extreme period right now of, if we don't do something radical, fairly radical, changing our lifestyles, the whole process to grind us down to minimal existence.
He's referring to the laws of conservation of energy. Well, first of all, the first and second laws, the first one is that you can't destroy energy. That's the good news, but the bad news is the second law, which says that any time you convert energy from one form to another, there's it's degraded, and it's usually a loss into heat, and your steam goes to water, and it's a cooler thing, and you have a lower form of energy. And
he said you can temper, so you can get the illusion of going back to the opposite direction, but actually what it does is it requires more energy to backflow. And so his overall condition, he extrapolated not only to energy, he's talking about a milieu of areas, but it's a very unsettling book. I'm just wondering if you had anything to address it with. You think it's a correct paradigm for our existence, or it hasn't been disputed as far as he claims.
Yeah, certainly it's true that we're headed that way. I'm not so sure I agree we're going there that fast, but, well, certainly fast enough, but there is, you know, we'll never run out of energy. There's more energy hits the Earth from the sun each year than, in fact, the total energy hitting the Earth each year from the sun is about 50 times the total fossil fuels in the world. So that there's a lot of energy. The problem, of course, is that it's diffuse, and you don't always get it when you want it, where you want it, and then how to collect it and transport it to where you want it. So there is energy, and on Saturday we want to talk about biomass, which is really another form of solar energy, and might mention that Barry Commoner, in his way, he of course then claims we have to go solar, and he has some ideas that I'm sure are controversial as to how this would work. He also maintains, and is probably right, that we must make a choice, either go solar or nuclear, that the economic system simply cannot afford to do both. That there just simply is not enough capital to go both ways. If you go nuclear, of course, you're basically saying that you're going to have huge plants and you are going to live electrically, really, because that's what you will get. Now, his plan for solar also has quite a dependence on electricity, too. What he proposes is that we have a lot of cogeneration, small internal combustion engines at each home, which generates their electricity for that home. And then in the wintertime, you know, the heat that you give out of your radiator on a car is a lot of the energy. It's a fair share of the energy. That you run a small internal combustion engine to run a generator to get electricity for your electrical needs, and then the heat, instead of exhausting the heat from the radiator outside, you use that to heat your home. And that it does. It brings up the efficiency then of the fuel considerably, where you're making use of that heat. And of course in the summertime you can use that heat to run a air conditioner. Forget what they are, we don't have them at home here.
6 years ago, Fortune magazine had an article on Westinghouse
where they were proposing to mass produce nuclear plants, basically mass produce, I think off the Virginia coast, where they would build a dike out in the ocean, build a nuclear plant, then float it anywhere in the world and operate it. Which to me sounded beautiful at that time. This year, they finally got licensed to do that. 6 years ago, they started just to get permission to do it. This year, we gave them permission. I think that's part of our problem we have today.
Well, it certainly adds to the cost. There's no doubt about that. That you, as the bureaucracy increases, you have spent more capital so far in advance than when you will ever get anything out of it. I'm not so sure that floating nuclear plants are going to, will be the answer, but I know that has been proposed, and I didn't realize that somebody had actually gotten permission now to do that. But they have gotten their license to go.
Just the other day, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal. That
Interesting.
I don't know if they have a market, but...
Well, as we saw yesterday, talking about nuclear, the orders have gone way down, and I don't know of anybody that's putting in orders for new ones right now.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about your supposition here that muddling toward frugality, although I agree with the concept, I guess I don't have as much enthusiasm for it working. I guess I don't see in our country right now the basis for getting everybody to do this. I see exactly the opposite sort of thing. Our whole economy is based on a growth type of idea, and any type of thing that is going to change that concept is going to lead to tremendous upheavals as far as I can see it. And I don't think that the way our economy is based is that we're going to move in that direction. And I think that if the things, the consumer goods are there, people are going to buy them and use them. And I almost think that we're almost headed for some kind of ultimate calamity. Sometime when we run out of oil or something, or when we run short of oil in a way, we're looking at just a real fast phase down. Although I'd like to see the concept of slowly moving away from energy dependence, I don't see it in a practical sense.
I think it's happening. I think it already has happened in the last 3 years. Maybe started the growth started to slow down before that, and I think it has started. We're already in it, and I don't think we'll realize how much we're in it for another 10 years. But I think it has started, and I think what we want to see is that we don't drop it too fast.
Well, see, but the ultimate result of that has been about 10% unemployment and a tremendous drop in the economy and that sort of thing. And if you were to look at another energy decrease, assuming that that also affects the economy, you're looking at another 10% decrease or increase in unemployment and so on. I don't think you can do it.
Well, Rufus Miles claims that we will know that the people in this country understand the situation we are in when the government workers accept a cut in pay rather than layoffs of additional workers. He says that when that happens, the people in the country will realize the situation they are in and that people have to start living on less.
Well,
the government, of course, and politicians are, for the most part, going to try to keep us on an exponential growth because that's what the people, for the most part, want and hope for. And in Warren Johnson's book on muddling towards frugality, he'd say that's fine as long as, but they aren't, that's really muddling because the politicians are trying to keep us on that when it simply cannot be done. So that we will take small steps, we will be trying to go exponentially, but we'll always have to take a small step to do something and that we won't have a big sudden step because if the politicians, even if they do realize that they are not going to make a decision that says, okay, everybody, you cut way back, and we're headed on a downward trend because people don't want to think in those terms.
Okay, well, I'd like to offer one other maybe intermediate alternative, and that would be, at least as far as looking at our energy resources, to develop a number of different types of energy resources. I think one of the things that got us into trouble with the Arab embargoes and everything was our almost complete dependence on oil. And if we have a diversity of energy sources, such as solar and nuclear and coal and oil, then if any one of these things falls out, then we aren't left in complete chaos at any one point. And I think something like solar energy has great potential, particularly now in passive solar energy type of things. You were talking about the economics of nuclear energy. At least the economics of photovoltaics right now are not there as far as electrical generation. They may be someday, but I think if we look at a diversity of energy sources, then we're looking at least ways to compensate for loss of oil or something. Yeah.
What you're advocating is what's called a soft path towards the energy solution, where not only do you have a diversity of energy sources, but you also try to make them more localized so that you do not depend on one huge plant, so that Klamath Falls, Oregon probably has a geothermal generating plant, and somewhere you have solar where there's a lot of sun, and if you're growing, if you have waste materials from crops, that you will use that for biomass to produce either methane or ethanol or whatever, and that you do have a diversity, right?
Yeah.
And that really is what all three of these books I referred to would advocate, that we need to take whatever is indigenous to your area and make the best of that and try to be, in a sense, self-sufficient. Self-sufficient not in the sense of individuals, but as of a smaller group.
The one thing you mentioned about people taking cuts rather than layoffs, to me seems a very good solution, because just, first of all, it would take care of unemployment, and therefore it wouldn't push people out on having to get unemployment or welfare. Secondly, by just receiving less salary, people would naturally be inclined to be more frugal, because there wouldn't be the money around to spend. I know that what you're thinking then is that there'd be less merchandise, and the whole country is based on consumer, but then there'd be still more people able to spend less. It would be an equalizer too, plus a saver all around of jobs and energy. Don't you think?
Yeah, if you have an increasing population, well, that will, you could have an increasing economic base too at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But that would tend, still is somewhat self-defeating then, because our economy is based on increasing technology and an increasing economic base, so you have more people or fewer people doing more work, and if you've got more people, then you're putting them out of work, mm-hmm. essentially.
But if you didn't put them out of work, you see.
If you didn't put them out of work,
and then
what that would mean is
more people doing less.
More people doing less.
That's exactly what you're
saying. But maybe we have got this technology far enough for the world. You know, I mean, make it slower. When you think of how America has advanced in technology so fast compared with everybody else, and when you think how old the other countries are, maybe it's starting to slow it down.
Well, it is slowing down. For one thing, we've used up most theories, as I mentioned before. There are scientific theories that were thought up years and years ago, some even centuries, have just been put into practice. And it's gotten now so that almost every theory is put into practice almost immediately. And maybe we've reached the point where we need to do more thinking for a while on things. Well, maybe we are muddling right now. I sort of think we're probably in that right now.
I think we're in a greater technological change now than we have been for the last 20 years. We're just starting to digest the computer age, and it's having a tremendous impact on this country.
Yes, it is.
The change in employment is, with so many women moving into the industry, I think that's one of the reasons we have unemployment, is that we're digesting the change in our society. I think we probably have more people working today than we did 2 years ago or 3 years ago, even though we have more unemployment, because there are more people, a higher percentage, looking for work. But if you look at Japan, which imports virtually all of their resources, they have tremendous economic growth. Their economic growth is almost double what ours is, percentage-wise, and they've been doing it for the last 12, 15 years.
Yeah, as you mentioned, we don't really have to blame technology or say that we don't want to continue that, because technology can can ease us into some of these things and save us energy. You know, the better communication systems, maybe we don't need to drive to where we want to go, that it's with new satellite transmission and whatnot, you can do a lot of your stuff that way and cheaper, and then using much less energy. So that technology can save us on energy and still keep our lifestyle at a good rate. And I don't think we should look at the future as being bad, that one can get satisfaction out of many things, and you don't have to burn up 100 gallons of gas driving from one place to another. You can get just as much satisfaction sitting at home or running around the yard or wherever, but reading a book or doing something else, and have maybe a more satisfying life than is always running, searching for something that you can't find out there, or to claim that I flew, I've flown the most miles and used up the most energy or something.